I had the privilege of reading, I don't know, maybe the first 50 pages of this book a year or so ago. And when I read it, it felt like a delightful Oscar Wildean, bon mot-laden, witty comedy of manners. But now your novel in five acts, The Wilds, is not that at all. Did it change in your mind, or is it become clearer to me because I've now read the whole thing?
Here is the problem I was facing.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 927, Lewis Byard's Wild. Novelist Lewis Byard's new book, The Wilds, a novel in five acts, tells the story of the fateful weekend in 1892 that spawned not only Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, one of the greatest comedies ever written, but the downfall of Oscar's family. It's witty, mournful, suspenseful, and surprising, and I hope my conversation with Lou about how his new novel came to be doesn't spoil your pleasure in reading it.
I wanted to write about Oscar Wilde's wife and children. Many people don't even know he had a wife and children. So that's news to a lot of people. But then when I looked at the arc of their lives, it was frankly very sad, very tragic in many cases. And I thought, God, this is going to be wretchedly depressing to write, let alone read. But then I thought about Oscar Wilde's example himself and how comedy and tragedy are never too far removed from each other. They're twined in a lot of his work. So I thought, okay, well, maybe we can work against the tragedy by creating this Wildean comedy of manners. And that really is how the book begins. It begins as a Wildean comedy and then kind of gradually darkens as it goes along until by Act Four, we're in the middle of World War One with snipers and all sorts of other things. But
And that's an incredibly moving section, let me just say, for the record. It's and it really sneaks up on you. Sorry, continue.
No. I mean, that's kind of what happened. I wanted, but I didn't ever. So there's humor even in that section. And so I wanted to never quite completely give in to the tragedy. And never completely the comedy. It's just kind of try to keep that hybrid going through the whole thing. But there is a lot of sad stuff that happens on the page.
That hybrid aspect that you're talking about, I realized as I was reading it that this novel felt like a combination of your romantic novels, say, Courting Mr. Lincoln, and, say, The Pale Blue Eye. So I'm reading about Oscar and Constance Wild, but at the same time, there's this undercurrent of pending tragedy, this sense of mystery and intrigue that is so present in your other darker, air quotes, mystery novels. Were you conscious of that as you were writing? Oh, I'm writing a hybrid of my two styles?
Not until now was I conscious of that. So I thank you, Austin, for explaining myself to me, because I need people like you to do that.
Well, we're recording in June, and the book isn't being released until September. So I think I'm only going to be the first to make that observation.
Well, only because not everyone will have read the other work, but so that's there's something to be said for that. I mean, I don't think even in my darkest work, I think there's still humor. There are parts of Pale Blue Eye that make me laugh, actually. Yeah. So. Or made me laugh when I wrote it. So I've never quite abandoned one for the other. And my very first two novels, long out of print, were comic novels of romantic comedies set in DC. So that's always been a part of my world. And then I did the Downton Abbey recaps for the New York Times, and that was humor based. Yeah. So it's always been in there somewhere. But you're right. It's the concentration. How much of this? How much the dark and how much of the light go in? And for me, it's just guided by the story itself.
And yet, I imagine you had to find the story in this book because it doesn't adhere to the Aristotelian unities of time and place. It covers a lot of ground. It's sort of, you say it's a novel in five acts. It's Shakespearean.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored by that. Yeah, and well, the thing that's not Shakespearean is that the first act is by far the longest one, because I just needed the time to set up all these characters to set up this situation. Yeah. What's happening is Constance Wilde, who is really the primary voice for through most of the book, is slowly figuring out what's going on with her husband. Until now, she doesn't realize that he has developed this new homosexual identity, embraced this very fervent homosexual life. So it's very gradually dawning on her over the course of these few days that they spend at a rented house in Norfolk. And there are other characters mixed in there too. Lord Alfred Douglas is there. That's Oscar's new young lover. But again, Constance doesn't yet realize that. They have a married couple staying with them. All this, by the way, was factual. There really was this group of people. And when I did my research, it struck me that this was the moment where the Wilde family started to unravel, because this is the moment where Oscar kind of is pulling away toward this new life of his. And most of your listeners will know what happened. You know, he was tried for a sodomy, gross misconduct, something like that, and sent to jail, Reading jail for 2 years. I mean, that was, of course, back in the day when sodomy was a felony. And in fact, it remained a felony in England, I think, till well into the 60s. So, he paid the ultimate consequence for this freedom and emerged a broken man who never wrote another play and died not too long afterward. So that's kind of where all this starts happening, is at this vacation, this holiday in Norfolk.
It's funny, it's like the weekend where Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein.
and someone else wrote a vampire.
Yeah, that's like right.
The two tributaries of horror fiction started in this one weekend. In
horror
Geneva.
Fiction, science fiction, all of this. And you found this pivotal, fateful weekend. And I guess it's interesting, too, because I thought I knew some aspects of Oscar Wilde. But if I knew he had children, I had forgotten it. I guess I was also fascinated to discover that Oscar Wilde has a grandson who is still alive.
Yes. In fact, I just sent him a copy of the book. He's living in France. Yes, Oscar Wilde's still living grandson. I think he is maybe 80. Okay. The reason that such a person can exist still is Oscar's younger son, Vivian, married rather late in life and had a late in life son. So that's why he's still around. But I was able to have email exchanges with him, and it's been lovely. So.
Well, and Vivian, Oscar's son, became a biographer of Oscar too. Yeah. Am I right?
He wrote a book called Son of Oscar Wilde, which is one of the best portraits of sort of the private Oscar. And one of the things that emerges, and one of the things I found so touching, Oscar loved his kids and they loved him. They were a genuinely devoted family. So that to me makes the fact that the family was split up in the way they were even sadder. I mean, Constance and the two boys had to escape England, had to leave England, flee, change their names, create secret identities for themselves, new identities for themselves, just because of the scandal. They were kind of swept up in it, and it colored the rest of their lives, all of them.
Well, I think I know Oscar Wilde because I had the privilege of being the definitive 10th grade Jack Worthing in a high school production of The
Importance. I remember that production, Austin. I remember that.
Yeah. It's transformative for so many people. But Importance of Being Earnest has been repurposed in other media, in Jordan's What the Butler Saw, in Tom Stoppard's Travesties, and reading your novel made me understand more the dark undercurrents under that play.
Yeah. And what's fascinating is he wrote that play right when his life was falling apart. It's amazing. I mean, his life is literally falling apart. He's being followed around. He's being threatened by Bosie's father, the Marquis of Queensbury, and he's being blackmailed. And it's just his life is going to hell. And out of it somehow comes this perfect gossamer light farce that, as you said, has been influencing people ever since. And it's just fascinating to me.
This is Christopher Moore, the author of Fool and the Serpent of Venice, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2024, we'll be performing our special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged in Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Colorado. And we'll be performing The Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged for 3 nights at the South Padre Island Convention Center in Texas. And then next March of 2025, we'll be returning to the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts for the 3-week Lort Theater premiere of The Comedy of Hamlet, a prequel. Check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with novelist Lewis Byard, whose witty and suspenseful new book, The Wilds, A Novel in 5 Acts, comes out next week and is available for pre-order now. I guess that was one reason why I felt this undercurrent of intrigue and doom, because I knew enough about the story of Bosie, Lord Alfred mm-hmm. Douglas, and his father, and Oscar's imprisonment. But there's something in the writing too, because you foreground Constance's point of view, so the reader is discovering what Constance is discovering as she discovers it.
Yeah, in real time, in effect, in real time, fictional yeah. time anyway, it's happening before her. And yeah, it was something I was struggling with, because we know, the reader knows what the deal with Oscar Wilde is. His wife is one of the few people at this point who doesn't, but she's in a bit of denial, and she's trying to keep her family together. And it just takes her a minute. One of the reasons I should add that it took her a while is because Oscar was a very devoted husband. When they first began, he was, for the first 30 years of his life, predominantly heterosexual. There's no sign of him having any kind of same-sex relationships at all. But once the door was open, he walked right on through. But until then, you know, he was, again, very devoted to his wife, devoted to his children. So they were really a family that kind of wanted to stay together in the end.
Right. And Constance talks about that in the book, was that she rarely sees the public side of Oscar that he presents, the flamboyant aesthete.
Yes.
You know, she knows him as more of a homebody, and that dichotomy of his, I imagine, was it easier to depict Oscar Wilde through other people's mm-hmm. perceptions of him?
Yes. For me, it's the same thing with Lincoln. I couldn't do Lincoln's POV because he's such a mysterious figure in so many ways. Even people who knew him
right.
didn't feel like they really knew him. Yeah. And Oscar is just so multivarious and contains so many multitudes that I just thought it would be helpful to see him as he was seen.
That's
interesting. By family, by friends too, yeah.
That's in Lauren Gunderson's play, The Book of Will, doesn't depict William Shakespeare at all. He's dead before the play even begins. And yet, through the memories and recollections and perceptions of the people around him, a portrait emerges. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what you've done so brilliantly with Oscar Wilde and, of course, Abraham Lincoln. You know, yeah, this portrait emerges of this really fascinating, complicated author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there was no question there, just fulsome praise. Sorry.
I'll take it.
Did the book change in your mind from the first 50 pages that you sent me? Did my notes help?
Your notes were helpful. They were helpful, yes.
Well, but I mean, you know what I'm asking? Or did you know when you sent me those first 50 pages where this novel was going?
I really did know, because from the start, I wanted to address all the terrible stuff that happened to Oscar Wilde's family. And that, again, people didn't know about. Yeah. But I wanted to get at it in a different way that wouldn't make it just morose and unbearable. And it seemed to me an Oscar Wilde play is the best vehicle for doing that. So it starts out very much as the comedy of manners, that classic format, and then it just steadily darkens as it goes along from act to act, until, as I said, in act 4 you're plunged into the heart of the horror of World War I, and some of that darkness lingers afterward too, so it's always there, but there's also a quip waiting to happen, coming around every corner, so That to
there's
me
always
is...
a quip, and there's always hope, and there's even in that World War One section, there's always a kind of light.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that.
I guess my challenge now is whether to put a spoiler alert warning on this conversation, because I delighted in the book so much because I read it expecting one thing and getting something far richer and more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do I want people to read the book first and then listen to this conversation? What do you think?
Oh, no, listen to the conversation and then be inspired to get the book, right? Isn't that?
Yeah.
That's the hope. That's the dream. But yeah, I guess there are things we can't mention up front, even though they're usually a member, a function of the historical record. But
right.
Was there something in particular you had in mind? We can talk around it.
No, it's only the Act Three problems that we mentioned. No, but I remember we had that conversation via email about who is this book for?
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, you pick up a book about called The Wilds because you know something about Oscar Wilde, but maybe that's not true. Maybe you just go, "Ooh, Lo Bayard wrote a new book. This looks interesting." Yeah,
and it has a great cover too. I can say that since I had nothing to do with it. So, yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think a lot of people. I did field research in an informal way, and I asked people, you know, what they knew about Oscar Wilde. And that was an ongoing conversation I had with my editor. What knowledge can we expect of them? What can we expect them to know? What do we need to tell them? And I'm always about telling them as little as possible because I don't want it to be obviously expository at every turn.
Sure.
But I realized there were some things that I needed to explain. You know, I needed to explain that he was a playwright, for instance, not just Importance of Being Earnest, but Lady Windermere's Fan, which was a huge hit. He was enormously successful playwright in his day, sort of beginning the late, I guess, the early 1890s and
right.
carrying on. So that's a big part of his identity. But also his Irish mother, Speranza, who was not actually there in Norfolk for Act One, but I just wanted her to be there. So I plopped her there in the midst of the whole thing. So she, Lady Wilde, was this formidable character who started out as an Irish revolutionary poet and then married Sir William Wilde, a notable ophthalmologist, I want to say, and then had to become kind of recreate herself to fit into the style of a ladyship, and then ends her days in London as this very eccentric salon hostess. So a fascinating character in her own right, and one of my two Lady Bracknell figures. I'm such a big fan of Lady Bracknell that I basically tried to get her in twice in two different forms.
Did you ever consider writing this story as a play?
That's a really good question. And the answer is no, oddly, even though it would seem to lend itself to one. In some ways, it's more cinematic. The Act One, for instance, they're kind of darting about. They're going to the beach. They're going. Oscar and Bosie are playing golf. So there's a lot of action happening. But no, I always saw it as prose, but dialogue heavy, in effect. So one of the things about a book with a lot of dialogue is it tends to read quickly.
Yeah.
I think we read dialogue faster than we read regular prose.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that it has that feeling of pace, even when they're just sitting around chatting and yakking with each other, that it still feels like it's moving. Yeah.
Well, and the scene on the park bench and the scene in the bar both reminded me of the play you wrote during the pandemic.
Oh my gosh. Yes, which another thing you had a hand in or in looking at. Yes, it was a play called Sheboygan, which I haven't been able to get off the ground since it had a sort of fringe festival production. But that's the one real play that I've ever written. I've written sketches and things like that. But now, for some reason, I like what I like that prose does is it allows you to create the interior life to some extent of the characters. You can go into their heads a little bit. You can describe things a little bit. I used prose sparingly in this book, but it's there for a reason. And I like having that ability. To me, it does what an actor's, I guess, would do for play. It gives the characters a certain life coming out of them that the dialogue alone wouldn't do. But that's the hope.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Lewis Byard's witty and suspenseful new book, The Wilds, a novel in five acts, comes out next week and is available for pre-order now. Send us your fateful weekends via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks as always to Lily Toting Aesthete Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Jim Mershon. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Christopher Moore, who has a new novel coming out in 2025 that I can't wait to talk to him about. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 927 2781st of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Do you know what other, what's your next historical author with a queer subtext?
I do not know.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.